All right, we're on now. Public Safety Policy Finance Committee, and it's March 16, 2005. We have a quorum. The minutes are in the packet from the March 15, 2005 meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
Okay.
Representative Hillstrom so moves. Any discussion on those minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a number of bills today, but before we get to those, we have some visitors in the audience. I want to recognize them and say hello to them. We have, as part of the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Site Program, we have some students, ninth grade students, from Southview Middle School from Edina here today. I'd like to welcome you to our committee. All right, committee, we have, looks like, four bills today. The first one is House File 765, Representative Meslow, DWI Working Group Policy Bill. So you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Actually, I would like to begin by moving the House File 765 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. The motion is before us. Go ahead.
Second, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the DE3 amendment, which puts the bill in the form that is most acceptable, I believe.
All right, let's do that. Unless there's objection, we'll do that as a courtesy to get the bill in the shape that you would like on the DE3 amendment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 765 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If I could walk you through the DE3 briefly. These are changes to the laws regarding DWI forfeitures. This comes to us from the state DWI task force. And if we take it through by section, section 1 simply provides that if it is a test of blood or urine, which is done at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, that the BCA can directly certify the results of that blood or urine test to the Department of Public Safety rather than sending that back to the law enforcement office, who then forwards it on. So that's just a simplification, and I believe it will also prevent some errors that are presently occurring. Section 2 provides that when an individual petitions for judicial review of forfeiture of his or her license, that they are required to also serve the law enforcement agency that's involved. That's so that they can get that direct information rather than having that pass through a prosecutor's office, so that they know whether a challenge has been made or whether it's appropriate for them to proceed accordingly. Section 3 also, Section 3 is a technical cleanup. Section 4 ties with what we talked about with Section 2, only this time it applies to vehicle forfeiture. Excuse me. That's particularly appropriate because agencies will seize vehicles. Individuals have 30 days in order to challenge that forfeiture, and particularly when it comes through the Department of Public Safety, they may not always be aware when a challenge has taken place, so it requires service on the law enforcement agency, so that they're aware whether a challenge has been made. Doesn't take away anybody's individual rights in how they would challenge that. Section 5 is it relates to the chemical assessments that individuals are required to have before they would get their license back. Presently, those are sometimes done in court, sometimes done by private individuals. In the court situations, probation department will already have police reports, driving records, and that information in order to do the assessment, but that doesn't always happen in a private assessment. This would require that when a person's chemical dependency issues are assessed as a result of a DWI revocation, that he or she has to have that information available to the assessor so that the assessor can make a complete evaluation as to whether various treatment options are necessary for that individual. So that applies that across the board. And Section 6. I'm sorry. Oh, that's eight. Yeah, actually, Section 6 and 7 tie in with that. Section 8 is a repealer of something that was passed as a part of the .08. And those of you who were in the legislature last time may recall that that was one of those late night passages that we did on that final day, and there was a provision that was in there that that I'll say certainly I was not aware of, and I kind of at the last minute became a member of the conference committee that was involved in the .08. What that provision did, it would be interpreted, I think, to say that law enforcement agencies, every time they take a PBT test of an individual, need to provide a report to the Department of Public Safety of that PBT result, of any subsequent test result, and of the reason for the contact with the individual. Law enforcement is very concerned that that would be an extensive obligation with, frankly, no purpose that I'm able to discern. And so I can tell you that that would be very burdensome with no apparent benefit. And so that provision would be repealed. That has not taken place. That has not taken effect yet. That's part of the overall .08 bill that's scheduled to take effect on August 1st of this year. So that's a basic summary of the bill. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Professor Steve Simon from the University of Minnesota and the chair of the Minnesota DWI Task Force.
Professor Simon.
Enormous help. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Simon. I'm on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm the director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force. Task Force has been in existence for close to 25 years, and I've been coming to the legislature for about that time, presenting you with recommendations about how to improve Minnesota's DWI law. The task force is made up of police officers, prosecutors, judges, attorney generals, people from DPS, BCA, private defense attorneys, people from every part of the criminal justice system. We receive input from the people who use the DWI law. As you know, it's very complex, very broad, and we identify minor glitches and some major policy changes. What you have before you are minor glitches. They're technical in nature. They will have tremendous impact in improving the efficiency of the system without taking away any rights or changing policy. And I will quickly run through the bill. The direct certification allows the BCA to certify the Department of Public Safety of the results of blood or urine tests, be it of alcohol or a controlled substance. Currently, for breath tests, the driver's license is revoked basically within 7 days of the arrest, or 7 days after the breath test. We've done some recent research and analysis of blood and urine tests and DWI cases. The time to revoke a driver's license in a blood and urine case is about 7 to 8 weeks, much, much longer. We also know, and we've got some really good research that shows, the quicker that you revoke a license, the much more effective that revocation is in preventing recidivism. And so this change just allows the BCA to directly send the results to DPS. The results will still go back to law enforcement to use for criminal prosecution. Section 2, license plate impoundment. This deals with when there is a challenge to the license plate impoundment in court. And what it does, it requires that when somebody files a complaint and starts that process, currently the law just requires that they serve the commissioner. And the AG is the one who has to defend these things, and they receive delayed or late notice. Also, there's no requirement that when somebody challenges a plate impoundment that they include in their challenge the document who the offender is or the police agency that arrested them. Very often the vehicle is owned by someone else other than the offender. So the AG is spending a fair amount of time making phone calls and digging through records to find out information they need in order to defend these things. So this just requires, when there is a petition, that put a few pieces of information in it, and that a copy is served on the AG. It also requires, and it makes some changes in the hearing. First, it eliminates currently some issues that have nothing to do with plate impoundment. Basically, it eliminates the issues that are related to whether or not the offender or the owner is entitled to a special plate. And that is never part of the judicial challenge, that's something that's determined by DPS. So basically, those are the changes in the judicial challenge to plate impoundment. Section 3 clarifies something that the legislature fixed a couple of years ago in the license revocation area. Basically, it says that, and you said originally for license revocation, if somebody can successfully challenge a driver's license revocation because of an implied consent and the criminal case, the license should be rescinded. For plate impoundment, the language, and it was a drafting unit, said if somebody is either successful in the implied consent challenge or the criminal case, they get the regular plate back. What happens is that somebody goes into court and plea bargains a plate impoundment violation, such as a .20, down to just a regular DWI. The license remains revoked for that longer .20 period, but because the statute only says if you win one or the other, you get your plates back. The change that we're asking that you make is that you say you have to win both. And that's it's a matter of fairness, and it's a matter of trying to carry out the policy that the legislature adopted in the license revocation area. Section 4, again, very, very technical. It just says that if there's going to be a challenge to a vehicle forfeiture, that when the challenge is done in court, that a copy of the petition is served on law enforcement, so that they can start the clock and determine when the 30 days are up. They know when that is up, but it'll be easier for them to determine that there has been no challenge, so that they can begin disposing of a vehicle after there has either been no challenge or the challenge has failed. The vast majority of these forfeitures involve very low-value cars, and the law enforcement agency can't dispose of those until they determine that there has been no challenge. So this is just requiring a copy be served on them. Section 5 improves the assessment process, and I think Representative Meslow gave you a very good summary of that. This is very, very important, and this really will improve the public safety because this increases the likelihood that if somebody, a DWI offender, has a chemical dependency problem, it will be identified by the assessor. A significant number of assessments are done not in the court system but by a private assessor. Currently, the private assessor has no access to, nor are they required to consider whether or not the person had a .12 or a .25, whether this is their first DWI or their third, what the driving report said about their behavior. And so we're getting a disturbing number of false negatives. The person has a problem because these off-board assessors don't have all the facts. They're saying no problem. So this just requires that for the private assessors, they consider things that assessments done in court consider. And I think Representative Meslow did a real good job on the repealer. We'd like that to point out that if you look at if this law goes into effect and it takes 5 minutes for each one of these incidents, last year there were 34,000 DWI arrests. This would add another 5 minutes to that. Translated and doing the math, that's equal to over 1,600 DWI arrests, because a DWI arrest takes about an hour and a half, and that's going to consume that much time. So basically, we're taking officers off the street for a longer period of time. We're reducing public safety. Much of this information is already available at DPS or BCA. But law enforcement is very, very concerned, as you know, that they're struggling with limited resources and increased vehicle miles driven. And they want to spend the time on the street, not doing something like this. Thank you very much.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I came in late, so I missed Representative Meslow's yes. explanation of Section 6 on the delete all amendment. But Mr. Simon, maybe, or Representative Meslow, can you... I guess I'm thinking of the language that you've included in the method of assessment, and I'm wondering if you have a problem with having collateral contacts being made, especially with employers or it looks like educational institutions. I'm wondering why you would involve the employer in the assessment, and I mean, potentially could that be a job risk for somebody? It seems to me in other criminal offenses where there's alcohol involved that kind of collateral information is not so widespread.
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, the law does not require that it list those as possible sources. Usually the offender presents the collateral. They identify the collateral.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Simon, but it seems to me you're saying that I'm assuming that this would allow the probation officer to make this contact. Would that be the, or some person from the court?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, it's whoever does the assessment.
The outside assessment.
So this would actually apply to the probation officer doing an assessment.
Okay. So I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here. So someone gets picked up for a DWI, gets their car impounded, and the next thing he or she knows, their employer has been contacted by an outside assessor to try to find out if this individual has an alcohol problem. You know, I'm just wondering if this is problematic to you. It's, on face, it is to me.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, I can see the problem with that. As I said, it doesn't require that they contact the employer. They certainly can't do that now. And this is not core to this bill in terms of who they contact. It requires that they have a collateral. The employer thing, that's not core to this thing. One of the problems is that some of these assessments, output assessments, don't have any collaterals.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar. Certainly I can work with you on the language of that. I think the concern you're raising is certainly not the intent of what we're trying to accomplish with this. And if the language, in fact, does that, I'd be very happy to work with you on that. The intention is simply that there be a collateral contact, and the listing of those is simply intended to be a non-inclusive list of contacts that would be appropriate to fit the definition of a collateral contact, but the intention is that it would be the subject who would choose who that collateral contact would be made with, just as presently is the case. That's intended to be a non-inclusive list of examples that could apply, but it's not supposed to be a change in the way that's already being done in what we see in court-ordered assessments.
Representative Paymar.
So you'd be amenable to working on maybe adding some thoughts. Okay, thanks.
Back.
Any further questions of Professor Simon? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, if I could take you back to page 3, beginning at line 16, there's a number of items that have been deleted as being not relevant for purposes of the judicial review. Can you explain to me why those issues are not relevant and they're being deleted?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Newman, those issues have to do with whether or not the owner of the car is entitled to a special plate, not whether or not that the impoundment should be sustained. If when you take a look at them, those issues are ones that are decided by the Department of Public Safety. Because the determination of those issues would not affect whether or not the impoundment stays in effect or not. Because, you know, the first one that's deleted is whether he has access to the vehicle, and the second one is whether or not the member of the household has a valid driver's license. So these are things that have to be determined to issue a special plate, not whether or not the impoundment was proper to be issued and it should be sustained.
It was
a drafting error to put them in there.
Just one quick follow-up question. I just want to make sure that what we're not doing is impounding plates for people who were not in some way that they're not involved, and you know, I just want to double check that, make sure I understand correctly.
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Newman, clearly this will not increase the number of impoundments. It will not make it any easier to sustain an impoundment, because an impoundment takes place if it's the person's prior, if the person has no prior DWI, or if they have a .20, or if they have a child in the car, and the officer had probable cause to stop the car and the reason to request a test. Those are the issues that are being determined in an impoundment challenge. So the things that we're taking out, the person retains those, and they have to prove those things if they want to get a special plate.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive me if this question has already been asked. I tried to see if it was, and I want to talk to you about the provisions requiring forfeiture and the requirement that the police agency get served with a complaint. I'm going to lay out my concern, then I'll ask you a question. At this point, the whole burden is on the person whose car has been seized. I mean, the state doesn't even have to respond. The person has to file the complaint. They have to make sure it's served properly. They have to make sure the service process is included. But now there's an additional burden on that individual, which if they fail, and a lot of these things are pro se, they can lose their car. And it seems to me the simpler solution is for the prosecuting authority just to send a fax over to the police department saying, Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so has started a judicial determination of forfeiture. Why can't we just do that? Why can't the prosecutor just say, you know, Spring Lake Park Police Department, we've gotten a complaint on XYZ vehicle? Wouldn't that solve the problem that you're trying to correct with this?
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, this is a problem of the inability of law enforcement to find out that there has not been a challenge. Mainly occurs with the State Patrol. Give you an example. If an officer makes a DWI arrest on 394 west of Minneapolis, leaving from Minneapolis to get out to the edge of Hennepin County on 394, there's about 10 different cities that that DWI could occur in. The officer can make an arrest. The State Patrol can make an arrest. Then he or she has to figure out, you know, which jurisdiction it occurred in. And the problem comes is that when the officer, when State Patrol, and then they're vigorous in their forfeiture, when they keep track, you know, that's day one. On day 30, they want to find out if there has or has not been a challenge. And they're telling us that it's very hard, since they don't have that direct contact and relationship with their prosecutor like the White Bear Police Department has with Representative Meslow. State Patrol saying it's taking weeks to track down the prosecutor and to get information back.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
But I guess that is much of a problem as that is, and I do recognize that as being a problem. It seems like the greater problem is that we're going to take a family car away from somebody because they forgot to file some papers with the right people, even though they may have served on the prosecutor. And it seems to me that government has got to take some responsibility for communicating. I mean, it would be easy enough to put a tickler system in that, look, you know, we served this petition on this day, 30 days are up, we haven't received anything, police department, you can sell a car. But at this point, it seems like more and more the weight is being shifted upon the person who may not have counsel, who may not understand the legal proceedings, who might not even be able to read the forfeiture petition. It just seems unfair.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, I can appreciate your position, but you have to keep in mind that forfeiture kicks in at the third time defense. This person has been in court twice. We've called their attention to it, their abuse of alcohol, two other times. You know, the first time they get a fresh pretty lightly. The second time, they've looked at it very carefully. They've chosen to continue to drink and drive and endanger the public. And also, excuse me, Representative Ellison, the vast majority of these guys, there is no challenge. And this is the degree of the situation where there is no challenge so that they can determine that.
Last point on this point, Mr. Chair. If we're not talking about a flood of cases, it seems to me even more likely that the police and the prosecutor ought to be able to talk with each other. And then on the other side of the coin, I agree. I mean, if somebody has abused alcohol and their license so much that they're now facing forfeiture, fine. Follow the law, take their car. But what we're talking about is the procedure for that to happen. And it seems to me that we're tilting the procedural mechanism more and more in favor of the state. I say if you can prove two prior offenses, and if you can prove that third one, the car's gone. But we're not talking about the fact of a forfeiture. We're talking about, and whether it's righteous or not, we're talking about the procedures to which to make that happen. And I'm concerned that the state has the resources, that the state has the lawyers, the individual whose car being seized generally, I mean, may not. And, you know, we're creating another procedural hurdle when the state probably is in a better position to fix the problem. Now, can I get some of your thoughts on this subject?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison. I think, again, first of all, when we talk about this major burden that you're talking about placing on the defendant, what we're saying is send a notice to the agency that took the vehicle. That's
a complaint.
The extent that, well, the complaint that's already done. It's a complaint that's that already has to be completed for the other purposes. So we're saying send one more copy one other place. That's the additional burden that we're talking about. What we're talking about on the flip side is not so much the situations where the complaints are being filed. We're talking about really addressing the situations where the vast majority where complaints aren't filed, so that there's a follow-up on that, and so that we don't have the continued piling up of the storage costs that the agencies are incurring as they're continuing to hold the vehicles while they're waiting for the waiting periods, waiting to make sure that there has or hasn't been something that's been filed. I would submit that the burden that you're talking about on the individual is minimal at best, and that the impact that it has had on law enforcement is considerably more significant than that.
Representative Ellison.
I promise this is really my last one.
I agree with you.
All right. So my question is this then. Would you agree to include in this bill some language that says that if there's an inadvertent failure to serve the police agency, that it would not defeat or not cut off the rights of the person seeking to get their car returned? I mean, it's jurisdictional. The 30 days is jurisdictional. If you don't serve it within 30 days on the prosecutor, then you're done. You were warned. You were notified. But if you inadvertently forget to serve one of the the policing agency, could at least be that it does not create a jurisdictional barrier to you pursuing your rights to get your car back. How do you feel about that as an accommodation?
Representative Maslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I would love to be able to do something like that. My concern is that if we do that, then what's going to happen is law enforcement will already have sold the vehicle and we're already down the line. So as much as I would like to accommodate that concern, and it's not my intention to address what you're talking about, I think if we do, we might as well not put the provision in at all. I don't think that I can find a middle ground. I'm very happy to work with you. If you can come up with a middle ground that can work, I'm open to that. But I don't think that's a middle ground. I think that would be the same impact as if we removed the provision altogether.
All right. Representative Newman, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, along the lines of what Representative Ellison is talking about, is there in this entire procedure, along the road, any kind of notice that could be even a sheet of paper putting the defendant on notice of the procedural requirements? Is there anything like that in the bill that would, in effect, satisfy the due process questions?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, yes, in fact, that's what starts the 30-day clock, is that the defendant has to be given a notice that includes setting forth the procedure that it would take to recover the vehicle or challenge the forfeiture of the vehicle, and that would be included within that requirement.
Very good. Professor Simon, thank you for coming today. Your third witness, I believe, is not going to be here in depth.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Meslow, closing remark, then I'm going to lay the bill on the table.
I have nothing further to say.
Very good. The bill is laid on the table. Thank you, Professor Simon, again. We're going to move along to House File 665. Representative Meslow and committee, we do have four bills remaining today. We also have session at noon, so we've got roughly an hour and, well, we've roughly got 50 minutes left, 55 minutes. So let's be brief. And I do want to, we do have several witnesses on the last bill for Representative Greiling, so I do want to get to those and hear them. So be as brief as you can, and let's hear 665.
Thank you, Mr.
First
Chair.
For the motion, and then we'll have it on the table.
At this time, I would move that House File 665 be...
The bill is moved. It's
passed,
before us.
It's passed and referred to civil law.
Very good. Excuse me for interrupting. The motion is that the bill be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Committee on Civil Law. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 665 makes our statute books shorter. There is a provision in the statutes now that one of our old blue laws that says there is no service of process on the Sabbath. And this was something brought to me by a constituent, simply would simply would remove that old blue law and allow for service process on Sundays. It does not allow for service process on legal holidays. That's it.
Questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Murphy, it simply is providing an alternative. People can decide whether or not they're going to do service on the Sabbath. If it's a business, it's going to need to be a business that's open and it has somebody who's there who's authorized to accept service of process. It simply is updating the laws to, I think, reflect current situation.
Okay, we're going to hold for a minute. I'm making an inquiry right now. All right, before we proceed,
Representative Meslow, would you be amenable to amending your motion, and if so, to what?
Yes, Mr. Chair. At this time, I'm prepared to recommend that it be referred to civil law without recommendation.
Representative Pamer, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, so the current statute says Sunday when you talk about the Sabbath, because there's other Sabbaths. Is that what you're trying to change? Because
Representative Meslow,
he's saying it's okay to do it on other Sabbaths or other faiths.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kamar, it actually doesn't say Sunday. It actually says the Sabbath, and I can read that to you specifically. It says every legal service of process upon the Sabbath day, except in case of breach or apprehended breach of peace, or when sued out for the apprehension of a person charged with a crime, or where service is expressly authorized by statute, is hereby prohibited. So the statute actually says the Sabbath.
So, Representative Meslow, I restate your answer. The meaning of the word should be Sabbath or Sunday.
Mr. Chair, the statute is actually Sabbath.
Yeah, I do. Any further questions on this? We have a motion before us. Any discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, potentially a question for staff. Does that mean that anyone who served something on Saturday, because some religions have the Sabbath on Saturday, has been in violation of this statute?
Let sleeping dogs lay. Question was asked. Beth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, currently, when I looked in the dictionary, Sabbath is defined as Friday evening to Saturday evening for Jewish holidays and Sunday for Christian holidays. So that would be, I think, what the law currently is.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Isn't it common practice for the state to participate in the service of Fridays, evenings, and Saturdays?
I'm sorry, restate the question.
Isn't it common practice for there to be some service through the state and county governments to have people served on Friday evenings and Saturdays? Currently, are you aware of that practice, or do you know who we would ask about that practice? But Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at is...
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead. No, I'm not. I can't answer that. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at is, should this simply have different language and statute? You know, should it be stating Sunday, or should it be stating Saturdays, or, you know, what really is our intention? Because my Sabbath day happens to be on Sunday, but that doesn't mean that the majority of my constituents would happen to have theirs.
The Representative Meslow, your House File 665 is repealing that statute, therefore it goes away, therefore it doesn't say Sunday or Sabbath any longer. It says nothing.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Okay.
We would clean up potential confusion in the law. Another great reason for this bill.
Well, is there any further discussion? I'm not aware of any. The motion is before us. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Next bill. Representative Meslow, House File 741. If you've moved the bill, just leave it at that. Then we'll lay it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, we're making the statute books shorter. This is a quite complicated change. We are taking a statute and amending the word the to the word a. So we are shortening the statute books by two letters. For those of you who have been a part of the committee in past years, you may have a little Groundhog Day sense of this. We have passed this bill in 2003. We passed it in 2004. We passed it on the floor both years, but we were not able to get the Senate to act on it. It has now cleared one committee in the Senate. We have every expectation that the Senate's going to move forward with this. This has to do with murder of a child, and at this time I'm going to turn it over to Hillary Caligiuri, who can explain the background on the statute.
Ms. Caligiuri, give us your name and then go on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hillary Caligiuri. I'm a prosecutor with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'll be real brief because many of you have heard about this bill before. In 2001, there was a prosecution of a man named Latham McDonald Sr. He had a history of child abuse. There was one incident where he had taken a five-year-old girl, a household member, had shaken her until she fell to the floor, striking her face. Second incident was more serious. He took a hairdryer to the face of his one-month-old daughter, caused her severe burns. She was prosecuted for first-degree assault and convicted, the most serious level of assault. It's a presumptive prison commit, but the judge in that case, over the prosecution's objection, gave him probation. While he was out on probation, he killed his seven-month-old son. He struck him so hard in his torso with his hand that he lacerated the boy's liver and caused internal bleeding, and the baby died. Under current law, this was not murder with a past pattern of child abuse. Under current law, first-degree murder is limited to cases where the defendant later kills the same child that he has abused. So if a person kills a different child, even though he's gotten notice through his history that his conduct poses a severe risk to children, he escapes that first-degree murder penalty if he chooses a different child to kill. This is a real easy fix, as Representative Meslow said. Rather than requiring a past pattern of abuse upon the child, it would require a past pattern of abuse upon a child. So that if you kill a child, you've got a past pattern of abuse upon any child, you are subject to the more severe penalties of the first-degree murder statute. Our office believes it's important to hold repeat child abusers accountable and to give greater protection to children. For that reason, we strongly support House File 741 and urge it to be successful. Thank you.
Any questions? You have no other witnesses to testify, I believe. All right. Chair, thank you, Ms. Caligiuri. The chair lays the bill on the table. We'll move on to your next one.
Thank you, Ms.
File 695, recording device use barred in motion picture theaters. I see you do have a testifier. Let's see if we can address your bill in about 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 695 makes something a crime that I think most people already assumed was illegal, and that is the videotaping the videotaping of movies in the movie theater. So we're talking about people who sneak into the movie theater with their little handheld camcorders to make a pirated version of the movie and then go back out on the street and try to sell copies of that. I think most of us probably thought that was already illegal, but it is not in Minnesota. It is in 21 other states. This statute would make a first-time violation a misdemeanor, a second-time violation a gross misdemeanor, and a third-time violation a felony. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have Dale Heider here from the Mueller Family Theaters who can speak to Bill.
Mr. Heider, welcome. Give us your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dale Heider. I'm with Mueller Family Theaters, as they mentioned. But today I'm here representing the North Central Chapter of the National Association of Theater Owners. Right now, if we catch somebody in the movie theater with a video camera, there's nothing we can do except to ask them to leave. The bill today, as I mentioned, will give us the opportunity to call the police and detain the people. Right now, other businesses, other industries have that right. It's like a shoplifting bill. If they're caught in a video store stealing a video, they're prosecuted. Unfortunately, we don't have those same rights. Currently, the movie theater industry in Minnesota is made up of 170 theaters, and we represent about $21 million in payroll taxes to the state of Minnesota. If the movies are allowed to continue, or this starts to become more of a problem and they're recorded and sold on the streets, our revenue will go down, therefore we have to start laying people off. So I guess we're asking for your consideration to help us detain this and make it an offense. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer.
Mr. Hyder, thank you for your testimony. I'm curious, this is probably a pointless question, meaningless, but where do you find that a thief coming into the Mueller Theater out in Maconia would be sitting, and where would he be having this camera? It seems to be fairly obvious if you're sitting there holding a camera that it would catch someone's attention. Do they secrete these on themselves, or what's the deal?
Yeah, recording devices nowadays are getting very very sophisticated and very small. In fact, there was a news report last night about other recording devices of people. We've seen through different files that have been sent to me, cameras that are mounted within a pair of glasses, and a person basically just needs to pretty much sit still for a couple hours and record that. There's other small devices, pen devices, and everything that they've detected in the past that have been used to record movies.
Questions, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, just an observation. The bill certainly seems to me to be appropriate, especially when you compare it to shoplifting, but to tag someone with a gross or a felony seems to me to be significantly sort of out of scope with the charge. So just an observation. It just seems when we start moving up into the area of felony for, in effect, a shoplifting offense is too harsh.
Further questions or observations, discussion at this point? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mizzle, you said when they sneak into the theater. You didn't really mean that. You meant when they sneak their camera into the theater.
Didn't you see the Seinfeld with Kramer did it?
Actually, it was Jerry who ultimately did it. He was the one who was good at it. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, you're absolutely right. I misspoke. Thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Representative Meslow, maybe. I mean, the crime is actually taking the video. If there is no intent to... I guess I'm a little confused here. I mean, I understand that you don't want somebody going and taking a video, but I mean, what you talked about in your testimony was going out and selling it. Well, I mean, those are kind of two separate things. And so if somebody goes in and just takes a video to go home and see it in their own house, or if they have an intent to sell it, I mean, I guess there seems like there's something here that the severity is different. And I don't know how you address that, but the bill doesn't address that.
Well, Representative Eastland and Meslow, maybe it does. I'm looking at page 1, lines 19 to 23. It seems to me if you're wanting to do that, to just kind of take a few shots of the screen for showing at home or to take another look at it, you could get the consent of the theater operator, and then you would not be guilty of criminal use and or, well, it's no and or. You're either there to steal it or you're there for showing it at home later, and you could get the theater operator. Is that my reading of that line, does that answer his question or does it not?
Mr. Chair, it satisfies me. I don't know if it satisfies Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
I guess my thought is, and I mean, I don't think it's a big deal either way, but I think it's very different if somebody goes in and sits still and makes this movie, this perfect movie, so you can go out and you can reproduce it and you can sell it. That's very different than somebody that goes in there, takes the movie and goes home and looks at it again. There is the distinction in here in the bill. I don't see that would distinguish those two things.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that, I guess the way we look at it, even if they're going to come in and record it and take it home for their personal use, yes, they bought a ticket to get into the theater to record it, but when they take it home, they're then going to show it to friends, relatives. They're not only going to be the only person watching it, so therefore the other people that are going to see the movie are potential revenue dollars that we have missed out at the movie theater, which translate into tax dollars. And so I guess what we're looking at is stopping it right from the source, and the movie is the property of the studios. There's copyright laws, and I guess we feel that it shouldn't be recorded at all.
If I might follow up on that briefly, Mr. Chair?
Representative Meslow, do so.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, what I hear you talking about is something that may be a very appropriate issue for sentencing as opposed to whether or not that it's a violation of the law. It strikes me as similar to somebody who walks into a store and steals a candy bar as opposed to stealing $200 worth of items. Both those would be misdemeanors. And yet those might be very different types of crimes, and those strike me as appropriate considerations at the time of sentencing.
Any other questions on this? If not, Mr. Hayter, thank you for being here today. We'll see what we can do. Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
All right. Is Representative Greiling here?
Mr. Chair, we just sent someone to get her.
We'll wait.
Sorry?
We'll wait.
Thank you.
Representative Paymar, you know, we could have a testifier start. It's a little unusual, but I am thinking of trying to get us out of here with some time to get the session. Is that all right with you or not?
It's not my bill, but I...
I will wait.
They're here.
Is he four? Well, then we won't start with him. Well, the first witness we have would be Sue Abderholden, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Why don't you take a seat? Don't start yet. Who's the gentleman with you? Is that Mr. White?
Yeah.
Why don't you? The author is going to need room to sit when she shows. So. It is laid. Here we go. Representative Greiling, have a seat. Yeah, I will. Representative Greiling, welcome. The chair is going to move your bill, House File 17, unless someone else wants to. Representative Paymer raised his hand. He'll move the bill. Representative Greiling, it's before us, and we are going to hear it and then lay it over on the table for possible inclusion at a later date. We normally run till noon, but with session and such, I'd like to go through everything in about half an hour, if we can stay to that. Representative Greiling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that will suit our purposes very well, as well as the laying it over, because this is a complicated topic, and to get it out there and have people mull it over and have a chance to possibly discuss it later, I think is a very thoughtful way to take a topic like this. First of all, House File 17 I view as a public safety bill. I think members of this committee are very familiar with the sex offenders and the problems that you have when you have black and white sentences that end, but people aren't necessarily rehabilitated. And that's what can happen also with our current McNaughton standard that determines if a person is responsible for their criminal behavior and they have a serious mental illness. The way we do it right now, most people are just given a criminal sentence, and then whether they're rehabilitated or not, off they go. Whereas if you use a different standard, which is what this bill is proposing, then people would be more apt to have a chance to be civilly committed. And that way, we have an indeterminate sentence, and only if they're safe do they have a chance to get out into society again. And that's how I view this. They don't get off free if they are determined to be having committed their crime because of their mental illness. And I think that's a misperception that we should keep in mind with this discussion. And also, I'd just like to make a point that very few people with mental illness are violent. So this is a very small population that we're talking about. This is an outdated standard, the McNaughton standard. It's something that came up in the British courts over 150 years ago. And we've learned a lot about mental illness in that time, and so that's why we're suggesting that we discuss a different standard for Minnesota. Other states have taken this move, but right now we're in there with Mississippi and Alabama, whereas some of the other states that I would like us to be more associated with, like Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, have already adopted the standard that we're proposing today in this bill with the American Law Institute standard, or ALI. There's a report in your packet that, it's right here, Mr. Chair, if we could get the page to pass out the report. No page at the moment. Okay.
I think he's roaming the halls trying to find you, Representative.
Okay. Sorry about that.
We'll get your item passed.
I apologize for that. anyway, this is a report that the 1998 legislator, with some of us having been there and some of us not, commissioned this report to look at the guilty but mentally ill standard and this whole topic. And so this report was done and came in 1999 from Stephen Coleman at Metro State. And they recommended what we were proposing in this bill today as well. And what it does is it changes to this American Law Institute standard, shifts the burden of proof from the defense to the prosecution, and allows the focus to be more on the mental illness and the indeterminate civil commitment standard rather than the black and white you can get out whether you're safe or not standard. And so this is the chance to begin that discussion, and I'd like to now turn it over to the people who are here to testify. The first one is Sue Abderholden, who's the Executive Director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Minnesota. The second one is Kyle White, who is an attorney in the area who specializes in the issue at hand and other people with mental illness and other issues. And the third testifier, who isn't up here yet but soon will be, is Joanne Zwack, who has a son in Oak Park Heights.
Ms. Abderholden, give us your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sue Abderholden, the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I'm here obviously to speak in favor of House File 17, the bill to change the definition of the insanity defense. And as Representative Griley explained, Minnesota uses what is called the McNaughton standard. And it came actually out of a case involving Daniel McNaughton, who shot and killed the secretary of the British Prime Minister in 1843. So despite advances in psychiatry, we are using a standard that is 163 years old. Supporters of the McNaughton standard say that it has in fact stood the test of time. However, I would say that there have been many examples of terrible practices that were around for 100 or so years that didn't really stand the test of time. They were just difficult to change. An example would be women's right to vote, segregation, just to name a few. So just because something hasn't been changed for a long time doesn't mean that it shouldn't be. In the packet of information you have, there's quite a bit in there. The 1999 report that Representative Breiling referenced, again, includes the recommendation that the standard be changed from McNaughton to the American Law Institute standard. Very few people, as pointed out in the report, use the McNaughton standard successfully in Minnesota. The report states that for 1995 and 97, there were no insanity acquittals, and in 1996, there was one. It is far more likely for someone to be found mentally incompetent to stand trial than to be acquitted. The report opined that a contributing factor is certainly the stringent requirements that a defendant must meet to prove insanity, requirements that go well beyond the medical standards for severe mental illness. You also have in your packet a state-by-state listing showing the standards that are used. 17 states use the McNaughton standard: Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi. 8 use a more liberal version of the McNaughton standard, and 22 states use some version of the ALI standard. So basically, less than 35% of the states have held on to the straight McNaughton standard. Also in your packet is additional information from the American Psychiatry Association and a story that appeared in our newsletter several years ago that tells the story of a woman who did not meet the McNaughton standard and later ended up taking her own life while at the women's prison in Shakopee. As you decide whether or not the standard should be changed, I do want to mention that just because someone meets the insanity standard doesn't mean that they are free. People are committed to treatment and are not released until they are better, often resulting in being institutionalized in a hospital longer than if they had been sent to prison. Last week in the Senate, an opponent of this bill stated that this issue is not about modern psychiatry, but the question I'd like to ask you is, shouldn't it be? The U.S. Supreme Court just changed their decision about whether juveniles should, be able to, have the death penalty imposed on them. And part of their change was based on new research done on the brains of teenagers. We have a lot of research that's been done on the brain here at the University of Minnesota in particular, and we know that there are differences in the brain with people who have a severe mental illness. And we believe that we should use our best understanding of this biological brain disorder to determine if someone should be held criminally responsible for their actions. NAMI believes that the ALI standard is a better tool, morally and otherwise, for deciding this question. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next witness, if we could, Mr. White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Kyle White, and I'm a criminal defense attorney practicing in the St. Paul area. Formerly, I was the president of the board of directors of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Minnesota chapter. I've also worked as an advocate on an acute care psychiatric unit in Chicago. I'm here to testify regarding the McNaughton test, to suggest it's an outdated test is an understatement. It is a rule that ignores a century of scientific knowledge gained from the study of the human mind. From a legal perspective, I would compare it to the court's adherence to the rule of law that preceded Brown versus the Board of Education. The mentally ill and their families still live in an era analogous to those individuals impacted by Plessy v. Ferguson. And that's outrageous. It's just simply outrageous. McNaughton is a cognitive test. Its emphasis is on whether the individual knew right from wrong. It is an all-or-nothing approach that does not recognize degrees of incapacity. By focusing upon total incapacity, it refuses to recognize substantial volitional or emotional impairments. As a practical matter, McNaughton calls for a moral or ethical judgment rather than a complete scientific review of the mentally ill person's symptoms or the manifestations of his or her mental illness. Any qualified psychiatrist or psychologist would attest that the state hospitals, and more to the point, the prisons, are filled with mentally ill persons who can differentiate between right and wrong, but are still out of touch with reality. The insanity of the insanity defense may be best illustrated by the following example, if I may. Imagine a mentally ill person who suffers from an array of psychotic symptoms. He consistently experiences visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, and even olfactory hallucinations. The same individual has an imaginary person or figure who accompanies him throughout the day and tells him to do things, often bad things. He is actively delusional and experiences paranoid thoughts about people who interact with him. The voice or voices he hears commands him to do things, criminal things. He is diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. Now, the same person commits a very serious crime. Law enforcement interviews him, and as psychotic as he is, this person, this individual, mentally ill person, tells law enforcement he understands what he did. He understands that it's wrong. And under McNaughton, this individual is criminally responsible for his actions, even though at the time of the offense, the same severely mentally ill individual is actively psychotic and experiencing the whole array of psychotic symptoms. In law school, the professors who teach criminal law talk about that there are two components of any criminal act, any criminal offense. First, the mens rea, the guilty mind. Second, the actus reus, the social harm. If the state proves all the elements of these two components beyond a reasonable doubt, our laws typically require punishment. But if the guilty mind is really a sick mind, a mentally ill mind, then we should not, as a civilized, compassionate, and humane society, punish that person. The opponents here will tell you that mental illness issues should be best properly addressed at sentencing or disposition. But what you're doing is you're comparing apples and oranges. And I would be suspicious of this position because my experience has been that these same opponents will seek guideline sentences, if not upward departures, in cases where mental illness has been addressed and the Rule 20 evaluation comes back stating that the McNaughton test has not been met. It's simply what prosecutors do. It's their job. We have a system in place where if an individual is found not guilty by reason of mental illness, it immediately triggers civil commitment proceedings. The myth that a person who is found not guilty by reason of mental illness will get off by an acquittal couldn't be further from the truth, but that is the popular belief. A wonderful, delightful law professor that I had in law school, Dick Oakes, who passed away recently, used to tell the story about a client who had been convicted of a crime. At trial, Professor Oakes had represented this individual and had asserted a mental illness defense and lost when the individual went to prison. And some years later, after he had served his time, this same client called Professor Oakes asking to meet with him, wary of this former client's intentions, and particularly given the fact that he knew very well he was mentally ill. He said, "Sure, come on by and I'll talk to you." Lo and behold, the client stops by the law school to thank the professor for not prevailing on the mental illness defense because he figured that he'd still be locked up at St. Peter's Forensic Hospital. Without McNaughton, victims won't suffer any more or less than they already do. In fact, families like Joe and Joanne Zwack may suffer less and finally feel some sense of purpose for having undergone the horrendous experience of dealing with a system of justice that is truly blind to the mentally ill. Thank you.
Let's hear from Ms. Zwack.
Good morning. My name is Joanne Zwack, and I live in the Twin Cities. My husband and I have a support group for persons who have somebody mentally ill in prison, jail, or St. Peter. We have a son, Kyle, that when he was 21 and in his third year of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota, developed a brain disorder. He became paranoid schizophrenic. My grandmother was schizophrenic, but I did not know, as I'm 68 and people didn't talk about this years ago, that this was an inherited illness that could skip a couple generations. We tried to get my son committed, but the laws are more insane than the people. My son did not have the perception or insight that he was mentally ill. He was 21 years old. He had not committed a crime, and so they would not commit him. In the next couple of years, he lived in several southern states. He held 23 jobs. We never knew where he lived because he was afraid we would kidnap him. He would call collect from time to time, and I would send cash to postal money boxes or wherever. He had a hard time, you know, coping with reality and living. On February 11th of 1986, he called collect and said, "Mom," he said, "I was ambushed today." He said, "Three police cars came to kill me." My son fired 28 shots. One policeman was slightly hurt. The police fired 40 shots at my son, who was shot in the back 10, 12 times, shot in the neck. He wore a bulletproof vest night and day. And I called Bill Felvey, who was then the head of Ramsey County Public Defenders and a friend of ours. And I was so naive and stupid. I said, you know, he said, "Do you want me to get you an attorney?" And he knew Kyle was mentally ill. And I said, "Do you think I'll need one?" And of course I would need one. I assumed that we would get legal insanity in the state of Texas. They're under the McNaughton ruling, as is Minnesota. And the jury sent out a question, what would happen if we gave him legal insanity, and the judge refused to answer. He would have gone to a place like St. Peter, and the jury didn't want my son out on the road, and neither did we. He was sentenced to 45 years in Texas prison, and my husband happened to work for 3M, and in part was an expert in making license plates. I was in very many prisons as the vendor's wife for the tour, never dreaming I would go in the front door to see my son. I used to pick up their literature and found out that there was such a thing as the Interstate Compact, and I was determined to get him into the state of Minnesota, which I was able to do in 1990. And that, for the first time, he got medication. He got no medication in Texas, and he fully realized that he was schizophrenic and mentally ill, that it wasn't me or my husband or somebody else. And he was able to, he got on risperidone, and he was able to complete his college. He was in the honor unit for years. He was a tutor to help other inmates get their GEDs. He served a total of 18 years, and one of the men in the third car was a federal agent, and according to the laws of our lands, they could try him separately. After he was in Texas prison for a year, the feds came and pulled him out, and he had a trial. My son is not an attorney. He did not have meds, but the Texas judge allowed him to go pro se. My son did this very bizarre trial. In a federal trial, the jury determines innocent or guilt, and the judge determines the sentence. The judge stacked 17 years on top of the 45 from Texas, the same as if he killed this man, although an attorney assigned to sit next to Kyle argued that the third car was too far back to have been hit by a bullet. So in March of last year, the feds picked him up and they took him to Cherry Hut, Indiana, where there are no psychiatrists. One psychologist stood in front of my son's cell and said, "I don't believe you're mentally ill." Another psychologist took him off his antidepressant because, quote, "he didn't appear to be depressed." As a sheet that was passed out for you, he begs for his antidepressant back, but he can only see a psychiatrist every 3 months in front of a television screen. He was locked up for, they found a weapon in his cell with this other person. We offered to pay for a polygraph test knowing that he wouldn't have put a weapon in, but they did not allow that and the charges were dismissed. But in the meantime, he could only think of Senator Kennedy, and he wrote him and Senator Kennedy wrote Senator Bly, and we believe that he was the one that got Kyle transferred to Pekin, Illinois, and where he's currently at. He has been in prison now 19 years and has a minimum of 8 more to serve. I want to say whatever happened in any of your lives could have happened to us and to my child, but what happened to us could happen to any of you. And I beg that you will seriously consider changing the McNaughton ruling so we can get help. Persons who suffer from paranoid schizophrenia or serious bipolar, they suffer terribly in and of itself of the disease. They do not need any more punishment. They need help. They need treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Block. We have one last witness, and that's Mr. Backstrom, Cody County attorney. And each witness has been taking approximately 5 or 6 minutes. I'd ask you to do the same. Have a seat and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a handout for the committee. It's page.
Page is coming. Thank you.
James Backstrom, Dakota County attorney. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today to speak in reference to this bill. On behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which I serve on the board of directors, I can tell you that Minnesota prosecutors do not support a change in the current standard for mental illness for purposes of criminal prosecution. It is important, we believe, to have a very clear and distinct standard, such as that provided by the McNaughton Rule. This standard has stood the test of time. It was first adopted in England over 150 years ago. Minnesota has followed this rule for decades, as do 24 other states in our nation. It is a constitutional standard that is the basis for much legal precedent handed down both here in our state and in other states across the country. It is, in my opinion, the most easily understood and administered standard, which is exactly what we need to have in the criminal law when it comes to determining whether or not someone is guilty of a crime. This is not an antiquated or out-of-date rule that adversely affects the quality of life of citizens in our state, as some proponents for this change would like you to believe. If we adopt a standard of mental illness and criminal defenses that's being proposed, there will be situations, and you need to bear this in mind, there will clearly be situations when a person who understands the nature of their actions and right from wrong is excused from criminal responsibility for their conduct. I believe that this would shock and surprise the majority of citizens in our state. You should also keep in mind that I do not believe there's any public outcry for changes of law in this area. In fact, I don't even believe there's an outcry for change in the criminal justice system in which I've been privileged to work for over 18 years. You should also keep in mind that this issue is not something new, and that it is necessary, something is new that which is necessary to meet modern-day changes in our understanding of mental illness, as the proponents for this change would have you believe. The model penal code standard, which is commonly referred to as the ALI test, which is what this bill contains, was first proposed in the 1950s by the American Law Institute. In a very comprehensive and thorough article, which I will leave, I only have one copy of this, but I would like to leave it with the chair for your consideration, because it is a very thorough article which was written in 1967 by Joseph Livermore and Paul Meehl, an assistant professor of law at the University of Minnesota and a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Minnesota. It talks about the virtues of McNaughton, and this article explains some of the problems with the other tests, including the ALI standard that's being proposed to you today. Under the ALI standard, the use of the language such as substantially affects the conduct of an individual and their ability to, quote, appreciate the nature of their criminal actions will lead to a standard in criminal trials that basically will put this all in the hands of professionals and expert witnesses. And this language will mean, as the authors of this law review article point out, it will mean what the user wants it to mean. Use of the terms substantial and appreciate do not provide an effective limitation on the ambiguity they create, and they will, as this article quotes, necessarily bear the meaning that the user wishes. The bottom line, Mr. Chair and committee members, is that the test being proposed by the legislature confused the issue of mental disease with that of criminal responsibility. This is the basic, and in my opinion, the fatal flaw with all of these proposed standards. It's not true with the McNaughton rule, which makes the question of criminal responsibility the controlling issue through the concept of basic awareness of surrounding physical facts as they relate to whether or not the criminal defendant understood the nature of his or her actions and that they were wrong at the time they were committed. This is a test that lay people can easily understand and apply. And this is why juries in our state should be allowed to continue to apply the McNaughton standard rather than the ALI's test or similar tests. The fact of the matter is that this is the only standard that really addresses the importance of distinguishing a mental disease or defect of a criminal defendant from the moral responsibility for criminal behavior. The proper application of this standard will result in conclusions that those with serious mental illnesses that involve defects in reason, which keep the person from realizing the nature of what they are doing and that what they are doing is wrong, will be labeled insane and not held responsible for their criminal conduct. Under the McNaughton standard, testimony concerning the impact that less serious mental diseases or defects have upon a criminal defendant is simply not relevant to the basic question of moral responsibility. Although these conditions are very relevant to the disposition of the case, and as I will explain shortly, that's exactly the way our law treats this issue today. Adopting the ALI standard, I believe, will be a serious mistake in our states. I do not, with all due respect to Representative Grayling, believe this is in the interest of public safety. In fact, I think it is not in the interest of public safety or in the interest of justice for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. It will result, if adopted, in more acquittals, which will lead to more civil commitments in secure hospital settings at far greater cost than those associated with incarceration in prison. Who will suffer as a result of this? The victims of crime and the taxpaying citizens of the state of Minnesota. I also believe that this standard is a step towards opening the door to diminished capacity in our system of law, which is a very slippery slope down which this legislature should not embark. You should keep in mind that the test for mental illness proposed for you to consider today, this ALI standard, was exactly the standard in place in 1982 when John Hinckley was acquitted on the basis of insanity for attempting to assassinate President Reagan. He was acquitted even though he planned and carried out this violent attempt on our nation's leader, seemingly with a present awareness of the facts and circumstances around him at the time. He knew where the president was going to be. He had enough knowledge to bring a gun with him, obviously with the intent of shooting and killing our president. Under the McNaughton standard, he would almost surely have been convicted. But because he was able to find expert witnesses to testify that due to mental disease or defects, he lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Keep in mind that after his acquittal, the U.S. Congress abandoned the ALI standard and that 36 other states adopted laws making it more difficult to prove insanity in their courts. Notwithstanding this information, you are now being asked to revert to the same standard, which will make it easier for criminal defendants to claim and prove insanity in our state. I caution you to think very closely about all of the implications of doing so. When you look at the large number of mental illnesses and deficiencies that are articulated in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, commonly known as the DSM, the number of these afflictions is staggering, and that experts will be able to rely upon those types of diseases, such as attention deficit and disruptive behavior disorder, substance abuse disorder, various types of depression, anxiety disorders, sexual disorders, impulse control disorders, antisocial personality disorders, just to name a few, can be relied upon to show that somebody does not substantially understand the nature of their actions under the ALI standard. The bottom line, Mr. Chair and committee members, is that we should not excuse someone for committing a crime because they suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress, impulse control or anxiety disorders, or some of the many other mental diseases that are reflected in the DSM manual. We need to maintain a clear, concise, easily understood, and just standard, and that is exactly what the McNaughton Rule provides. Equally as important, Mr. Chair, is the need to maintain the burden of proof on the defendant when considering the mental illness and insanity defense. Shifting this burden to prosecutors in our state will make even more acquittals a reality. And while I believe that there is no compelling reason to change the standard of McNaughton that has worked so well for so many years in our state and that is so clearly understood, and that we should not do so, no matter what standard we adopt for proving mental illness as a criminal defense in our state, the burden of proof should remain with the defendant. Keep in mind, this is a criminal defense. The burden rightfully rests on the party asserting it. Do not place the burden of proving this upon the prosecutors of our state in the guilt phase of the trial. Questions about the level of a person's mental functioning and the impact that a mental illness or deficiency might have on their thought process at the time they were committing a crime rightfully belongs in the disposition phase of a criminal trial. It is in this phase and not the guilt phase that of a trial that questions of when gradations of a criminal defendant's mental illness or deficiency substantially affects their ability to control their behavior rightfully belongs. And this is what our law currently provides. Under sentencing guidelines, mitigating factor number 3 currently states that the physical or mental impairment and lack of substantial capacity for judgment when the offense was committed can be taken into consideration by the sentencing judge and used for a downward departure. Similarly, Minnesota Statute Section 609.1055 currently allows for alternative placements for offenders who suffer from serious mental illness. This statute allows a court to consider a defendant's persistent and serious mental illnesses if they are in the interest of public safety and provide an alternative placement outside of the prison system with conditions that they successfully complete treatment.
Mr. Baxter, I'm going to have you conclude at this point.
If I could just one second to sum up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The position of the county attorneys in our state should not be read or thought of as meaning that we do not support the importance of treating those with mental illness in our society. Surely this is needed in our state, and our state's prosecutors support the importance of providing adequate treatment for those who are incarcerated in our prison system and those who are in our society without having committed a crime. We believe that if that proper treatment is provided, we can perhaps avoid some criminal conduct. I would ask you just to review to my written comments for more details about our position, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. We've received those. I'm going to have them copied and distributed to the committee members. Representative Dreiling, I'm going to lay the bill on the table and notify you when we will be taking it back up if you choose to come back and provide additional input. But at this time, we're going to have to conclude. I want to thank you for coming forward. Do you have a very brief closing?
Thank you, Mr.
comment?
Chair, members. I just want to reiterate, I think it is cost is a factor here, because I think that was the key argument that Prosecutor Baxter made. It does cost more if you sentence people to civil commitments rather than prison. So I hope, though, that we don't make our laws always based on cost. And the cheapest thing, of course, is prevention, to make sure people get help before they get into a criminal debate. But once we do, I think we have to look at a lot of factors, including cost. But the most expensive place of all for people to be being served when they have a mental illness is if they are civilly committed or in prison. So hopefully we can all agree that what's done in the Health and Human Services Committee is the cheaper thing to do, and that's a part of the well-rounded picture. But this part is related to Health and Human Services as well. So I hope you'll keep that in mind as you discuss it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your presentation today. This meeting is adjourned.